John Constantine, a Hellblazer podcast.
Hey there, everybody, and welcome back. Before we get into the episode, just want to let you know that this is the free version of the podcast, and all that means is that we are way behind where I'm at in Patreon. So if you are loving this podcast and you need more John Constantine in your life, definitely go check us out at patreon.com/planestrainsandcomicbooks and sign up for the Hellblazer tier, where you'll get access to the entire Hellblazer library that I've recorded so far. And also, you get access to the exclusive episodes of the Planes, Trains, and Comic Books main podcast. So if any of that sounds good to you, definitely go over to patreon.com/planestrainsandcomicbooks, all one word, and sign up there. And with that out of the way, let's get into the issue. Today we are reading Hellblazer number 72. And just a little catch up on what's been going on in the last couple issues. For the last couple months, John Constantine has been pretty depressed. He's been living on the streets because his girlfriend Kit left him, and he and his best friend Chaz had a falling out, so John began to spiral into depression, and eventually he just ended up on the streets drinking, trying to forget what happened. And that lasted for at least a couple months, that is, until the last issue, where John ended up falling asleep in a drunk stupor next to a skeleton of a World War II pilot, and while he was passed out, he had a dream that was kind of like a vision of the last days of this pilot's life on Earth. And in this dream, this pilot fought to live until the very last second before he died. And when John woke up after this vision, and then he turned and saw the skeleton sitting next to him, he realized that this wasn't just a dream, this was like a vision of this actual person's last moments on Earth. And seeing that it was real, and also I think he got the feelings and everything of that pilot during that time, it changed his outlook on life. And even though stuff still hurt with Kit and Chaz, he decided that it's time to move on. It's time to stop being depressed and try to make the best of life going forward. And we left off with John in the last issue, with him using some little magic to get the checkbook and billfold off a man walking on the streets, and then he used that money to get himself a hotel and clean himself up. So it looks like going forward, we're going to have our usual John Constantine trying to build his life back up after he sunk so low. So first things first, with issue 72, we got the cover here. We see there is the Statue of Liberty, but instead of a woman's face, there is a skeleton face, and her skeleton hands and arms are holding the torch, just like they are on the actual Statue of Liberty. We see that this issue is written by Garth Ennis with art by Steve Dillon. And on the first page, we see a black woman walking on some sort of tropical beach, and she just looks like she's walking and thinking. And over these panels, the narration says, "It's gonna be a good day. Uncle Neville lit the ganja chalice first thing as usual. So Sadella goes strolling through the surf and clears her head. She likes it out here, far away from Trench Town. All the noises from the earth and sea instead of the shouts and screams. Not a city girl, Sadella. Things are nicer here. No orders, no choices, no people, no pressure. Little brother Linton's better too, without Papa's spirit nonsense in his head. Boy was getting so twisted up, disappearing in himself." Then we see the woman turn her head towards the tree line, and then she turns back away and the narration continues. "Noise from the jungle, but it's only Linton, and Sadella lets the morning back inside her, calm and mellow like bathing in the stream. And she's dead before she knows what hit her." Then we get a panel that's completely black, and as we turn the page, we see an airplane flying in the sky, and over that we see John's narration say, "This is just my bloody luck, isn't it?" Then we cut to inside the plane, and we see he is on a window seat, and he is stuck next to a man who won't shut up. And John's narration continues. "Christ knows why I keep trying these stupid ideas to beat jet lag. But anyway, get the early flight, get some kip. And with the time difference, I'll be up and at him the minute we hit New York." Then we get a panel of the man talking next to him saying, "Real ale, son, that's what I'm talking about. Not this Yankee piss you get in Ponzi wine bars. And what's more, have you seen this Dago crap you stick a bit of fruit in it? And what's the bloody point? Real ale's what you want. So thick you can spread it. And if you ask me..." And of course, John did not ask him, so he looks pretty annoyed, and we get more of his narration as he stares at the window. "And the best bit, the very best bit, is that they only had one seat left, right? Guess where?" Then we see his eyes flick over to the no smoking sign. So I guess in 1993, you could still smoke on planes if you were in the designated smoking section. So in an effort to ignore the man who keeps talking next to him, he picks up a pen and starts filling out his immigration form, and his narration continues. I try ignoring the fat bastard and filling in me immigration card. Always a laugh, that. It wants to know, have you been a mental patient, a drug abuser, a smuggler of controlled substances, a spy, or a Nazi war criminal during the period of 1939 to 1945? Yes. Yes, very much so, thanks. All the time, mate. Not as such. And not me, but I know a bloke who was. As if you'd actually admit to it. Ugh, for frig's sake. Then the man talking to him cuts back in saying, cocktails? Don't bloody talk to me about cocktails. Load of shite. Harvey Wallbanger? Harvey my ass more like. A nice pint of real ale? You can't beat it. So as John finishes his immigration card, he tries desperately to find something else to distract him from this man talking. So he pulls out a magazine from the back of the seat in front of him. And as he reads, his narration continues. Then I seek refuge in the in-flight magazine, which just goes to show how sad some people can get. Then he sees something interesting in the magazine, and his narration says, here, what's this? Then we see like a personal ad taken out that says, have you been involved in any of these practices? And then there's like a yield sign, and inside that sign, there's a big words that say warning. And under that, in descending order, it says, sorcery, witchcraft, palmistry, Satanism, Ouija, fortune-telling, levitation, automatic writing, astrology, pendulum, black-white magic, Lucifer, spiritism, mediums, tarot, curses, divination, magic, evil, spirits, Halloween, games, fantasy, omens, horoscope, trances, charms, UFO, hex. And then there's a little section underneath that that says, for inquiries and free literature, P.O. Box 787, Birmingham. So this is some sort of anti-witchcraft little ad someone put in this in-flight magazine. And as John reads it, he gets a big smile on his face and his narration says, 10 minutes worth of casual evil, at least. Then we see him pull out a notepad and he writes, dear sir, I was on holiday in the United States when I noticed your advertisement. I, too, am increasingly concerned about the rise of dark satanic powers in modern society, both in the areas you have identified and by more sinister, underhanded methods like rock and roll music and acid house parties. Please send me your anti-black magic action pack as soon as possible. I am particularly concerned about the devilfish you mentioned and the horrors of automatic writing. Last year, a fellow student at my college attended a tarot reading. I am sure that with your action pack, I can prevent such foolishness in the future. I enclosed a stamp and self-addressed envelope. Yours sincerely, Nigel Archer. And if you don't remember who Nigel is, he is like the communist magic friend that John has that was like helping him out during the Royal Blood storyline. So basically, he's just messing with his friend and sending his address to this mailing list. Then John tears the page out of the notebook and his narration says, mustn't forget to post this. Frig me. Better be careful of those various alternative therapies. Then the man next to him, who won't shut up, starts to stand up, and as he does, he's saying, had a pint back in the departure lounge. You call that strong ale? I've had stronger glasses of baby shim. Oh well, I'm off for a shit. Back soon. And as the man stands, John says, brave man. And as he says this, John has a big smile on his face, so you know he's up to something. And as the man gives him a questioning look, John continues, if you're willing to trust these airplane kazis, mate, you're a better man than I am. And the guy, still confused, asks, what do you mean? And John continues, well, thereby hangs a bit of a tale. This bloke I heard about, right? They hush this up, but they always do, you know what I mean? He's on this jumbo jet, and he goes for a crap, and suddenly, whoosh! And the man looks kind of scared and says, whoosh? And John continues, yeah, bloody Aerobog goes apeshit and sucks his guts out through his arsehole. And the man, beginning to look terrified, says, you're not. And John cuts him off saying, no word of a lie, squire. Then he continues his story. There's this plane bombing along with 20 foot of intestine hanging out the back. And on the end of it, the little sphincter is still snapping away like a billio. Had to stuff it all back up him with a pointy stick, I heard. Still, it's your arse, mate. Best of luck. Then the now terrified man decides he's not going to use the restroom. And we get a panel of him trying to hold it dearly like he really had to go, but that story made it so he's definitely not going to. And because he's concentrating so hard on not going to the restroom, he's not talking anymore. And John smiles as he looks out the window and his narration says, he's a lamb after that. No trouble at all. And I doze off watching the stewardess's tits. Then we cut to John walking the streets of New York, New York. So if you didn't guess from the cover, obviously John is visiting America in this issue. So as John buys a hot dog from a hot dog vendor on the street, his narration says, I love this place. Maybe that's why I chose it to take a breather in. I don't know. Maybe it's just because I'm an outsider. But this town really picks you up and sends you down a lunatic staircase. And you reach out and grab whatever it'll give you. It's too big to be real. And as John finishes his hot dog, he looks up at all the skyscrapers and his narration continues. It's too big to be real. The sun bounces off these great glass ladders built to heaven, and you're nothing one minute, and the next, you're a giant in a world built specially for you. It sings to you. It laughs at you. It whispers lies you want so badly to believe more than anything else, and this is really why I came here. It's something new. And as he walks, we see him pass a homeless man whose sign says, Navajo Indians, please help, I want to go home. But John doesn't really take notice of him, and he pulls out a cigarette and lights it, and as he does, the narration continues. I haven't the words to describe it, so what the hell? I'll just use someone else's. In Manhattan's desert twilight, in the depth of afternoon, we stepped hand in hand down Broadway, like the first man on the moon. And the blackbird broke the silence, as you whistled it so sweet. And in Brendan Behan's footsteps, I danced up and down the street. And those are actually song lyrics from the band The Pogue and the song Thousands Are Sailing. And we see on this page, as John smiles looking at New York, that the name of this issue is Damnation's Flame Part 1, Brave New World. And as we turn the page, we see John is continuing to hum the Pogue song, and then he's walking into a bar and restaurant called the Blarney Stone. And as he enters, we see the man who's tending bar talking to someone else, and then that man turns and sees John enter and says, Hello, John. And John looks up surprised and says, You remember me? It was 10 years since I was in here. And the man reaches out and shakes John's hand and says, Oh yeah, what'll it be? And John smiles and then he sits at the bar and he says, Pint of Mick, sorry. Because he doesn't remember the bartender's name, so the bartender waves it off and says, Peter, you on holiday? Then he hands John a full pint, and as John's about to drink it, he says, Yeah, that's bloody incredible, you still knowing me after all this time. And as John downs his pint, Peter says, You were in the back room with a couple of fellas. A big lad from Dublin, Brendan. And then he sees John finish his pint really quickly. So he fills another glass and hands it to John as John finishes. And he says, Needed that, huh? Here you are. Don't worry about it. Welcome back. And as we turn the page, we cut to them a while later. And the bartender, Peter, is saying, And the trouble with St. Pat's. It's all the amateur friggin' drinkers come up and get stupid on a pint and a half. Oh, you wouldn't believe it. And John cuts in, These kiss me, I'm Irish lot? And Peter answers, Yeah, kiss me, I'm Irish. I'll put me boot up your arse, you're Irish. Kids, you know, frickin' yuppies and all. Ah, excuse me. And as Peter goes to help another customer, John looks around and he lights a cigarette and sees all the happy people drinking. And his narration says, I could happily stay here for the rest of me natural. Says the man on the eighth pint. 1983. Me, Brendan, Cox, Carlotti, and Skurve the elephant handler, all sitting in the back there, pissed as farts, and hoping the Duke's ghost would forgive us. Brendan skids his elbow on Carlotti's puke and says, looking round with an Irish bullshitter's squint, Ah, John, it's not Ireland, is it? But it's Irish enough that they don't have to be American. Sure would know how if they did. And isn't that what everyone wants to take to the future anyway? Just the good bits of the past. And then John smiles to himself as he thinks about this conversation he had with Brendan, and his narration says, Brendan, I said, never a truer word spoken. You're round. Then we see Peter the bartender walk up to John with a full bottle, and he says, Shots? And John looks at him with a smile and says, I'm game. And as we turn the page, we cut to the outside of a very tall building, and we hear someone say, Not funny. Then we cut to the inside, and we see two people talking, one of whom we have seen before. That person we haven't seen for a while. In fact, it was the last time John was in New York, which is from issue 2 of Hellblazer. And this is the same person that he met in that issue, who is named Papa Midnight. And John and him have a long, sordid past that we never really got to know about before. We just know that they're kind of competing magicians who don't like each other, and that John likes pushing the buttons of Papa Midnight, and he gets a kick out of making him angry. We also know that Papa Midnight is a different kind of magician than John is. He's more into the Haitian or voodoo magic. And he actually owns this very tall building, And on the first floor, there's a nightclub, but there's a bunch of other shady stuff as you go down into the basement levels. And he was the one who said not funny. And as we cut to the inside, we see he is talking to a skinny white man. And the white man saying, "Who's friggin' joking, Midnight? I saw the bastard myself, okay? You think I'm gonna forget him? Wake the frig up, all right? Jesus Christ!" And Midnight replies, "Zirky, it has been a long uphill struggle, has it not? From orphan to catamite to fully fledged piece of excrement. Not so much a man as a smear. I can assure that descent will be much, much faster, if you like." And just in case you forgot, Papa Midnight is a very large black man. And as he said this last line, you can see that he was very angry and he kind of turns. So we can definitely tell he was threatening Zirky. And Zirky definitely picks up on this threat and he says, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, okay? Be cool. No offense, Papa, okay? Just a little jumpy today. I mean, Jesus, I'm sitting there and this son of a bitch rolls in off the street and I'm a little freaked, you know?" And Papa asks, "Where?" And Zirky replies, "Bar on 32nd, near the garden." And Papa asks, "No doubt?" And Zirky, who's getting more and more nervous throughout this conversation, answers saying, "Hey, look, raincoat, suit and tie, chain smoking them shitty British cigarettes and that friggin' unbelievable accent. Who does that sound like to you?" And Papa Midnight asks, "Why didn't he recognize you?" And then Zirky gets a big smile on his face and says, "That's the thing, Papa. That's the friggin' thing. He's changed. Shit, changed? He's a regular wimp. In he comes, right? And he looks at me and I crap my pants. And then I see he's looking clean through me. I ain't changed jack shit about me since 83. And I'm the guy who stuck the gauge up Cox's ass and covered Constantine's stupid coat and guts. And he didn't friggin' realize. Not once. It gets better. He's sitting there talking about friggin' Dublin with the old guy at the bar. I wait 2 hours and he's talking like some asshole fresh off the boat. No sinister shit, no shady mothers showing up. So you know what I do?" And Papa Midnight sarcastically says, "Enthrall me." And Zirky continues with a very shit-eating grin on his face and he says, "I stick a Marlboro in my mouth and I walk up to him and the prick gives me a freaking light." And Papa Midnight, whose patience is wearing thin, says, "And?" And Zirky continues, "And I walk out, no problem. I'm telling you, Papa, he's lost it." And finally, Papa's very happy that the story's over and he says, "You have delighted me long enough, Zirky." So Zirky takes the hint and he begins to walk out. And as he does, he says, right, yeah. Give me a call if. And he just leaves it there because he realizes that Papa does not want to hear his voice anymore. So he just stops talking and walks out of the room. And after he leaves, Papa Midnight turns around to the little altar that's in his office where there's two candles burning. And in between the two candles, there is the skull of his sister, who I believe is supposed to be the woman named Cadella who was on the first page of this issue, which, looking back on that, now insinuates that he, the little brother, killed her on the beach so that he could use her for his magic. So as Papa turns to his sister's skull, he says, "If it were true, if..." And he doesn't finish his sentence. He actually walks over to his sister's skull and picks it up, and he looks it directly in the eyes and he says, "Open your eyes, sister. Tell me, can I take him on a walk through hell?" And as he says this last line, he gets a very sinister look on his face. Then we turn the page and we cut to John walking out of the bar. And John is asking him if they're on for tomorrow night. And Peter's saying, yeah, he's on at 4. And as John walks down the street, he passes another homeless man that's sitting on the ground. And this person is wearing sunglasses as if they're blind. And as John walks by him, the man removes the glasses and we see his eyes are completely removed. But not just his eyes. The skin around his eyes is completely pulled back as if it was torn off. So what you can see is him looking at John, but he doesn't have any eyes inside of his skeleton sockets. And this seems to be the beginning of what Papa Midnight was asking his sister's skull to do with John. So we cut from that man's skull to a field of spinal cords with skulls attached to them that are dancing in the wind, kind of like flowers that are growing in the wind, but much more macabre. And the narration says, "Someone's coming. The word went out from Martha's Vineyard. Strange fruit howling on an even stranger wind. And everyone and everything from sea to shining sea stopped, and they listened to the news that they never thought they'd hear. In Manhattan, the street signs whispered it from block to block, careful to be heard above the 1,000,000,000 gunshots, and pass it on." And under this narration, we see the face of a man who either looks like he's been shot or possibly run over, but the panel's not big enough to really see what happened to him. You just see blood trickling down his face, and his lips are opening like he's moving. So this is probably a dead man who's whispering whatever he's supposed to pass on. In the next panel, we see a dollar bill, and the narration continues. The greenback ceased confessing, albeit briefly, and pass it on. So literal money is talking and passing it on. Then in the next panel, we see a hand holding a rose, and that rose has grown vines that are wrapping around the person's forearm, and it's digging in with its thorns and causing the person to bleed. And the narration continues. The moon child stopped choking on the thorns that lined her throat, but all that she could say was, pass it on. Then in the next panel, we get an American flag and like a shadow of a person standing in front of it, and the narration says, Private Brown gripped his rifle good and tight against the cold and wondered when the sun would rise and pass it on. Then the next panel is the face of a man who's bleeding from his temple down. We can't actually see the temple, but it seems he has killed himself because in the narration it says, The man with the hole in his head, whose life for 30 years had been a flinch, a hiss, a pain he didn't dare to understand. He heard it too and pass it on. Then we get a very faraway shot of what I assume is a tribe of Native Americans, possibly, and they're on a cliff edge, but we can't really see them except it just looks like little silhouettes on horses. And the narration on this panel says, The one last tribe heard too. Then in the last panel of this whole sequence, we get the final person who hears this message, whatever it was that Papa Midnight has said, and we see it is the face of the first of the fallen. And the narration on this panel says, And far away in foreign lands, someone smiled a smile of whores and midnight and settled down to watch. Then we cut back to Papa Midnight's office, and he's still holding his sister's skull, but he has put on, instead of a suit that he had on before, his ceremonial garb, which consists of him wearing nothing but a loincloth and a white suit jacket and a white top hat with a pink band around it. And we see Papa Midnight say to his sister, It's true. Thank you, sister. Your eyes have shown me he has changed. His way wavers. He relaxes. Something has happened and his edge is lost. His behavior hovers on the edge of decent. And then his sister, who we can't really hear, but he hears, must have said something about caution because he says, Don't talk to me about caution. Constantine inspires a particular kind of hate. $50,000. The Ace of Winchesters. And all he does is flash that cursed smile. I swear that all the arrogance in the world is hiding in that smile. And then Papa calms down for a second, and he puts the head back on the altar, and he continues. I am not the first to notice it. To hate him is to think about him always. The thought of him is with you in your dreams. It colors every triumph, and like the man himself, it darts from nowhere to turn the world from up to down and black to white. And you never, never, never lose sight of wanting your revenge. And then we get a panel that's kind of interesting. It's of his sister's skull, and we just hear him say, But you could never understand, my sister. Almost as if it's foreshadowing that maybe his sister does understand revenge, and maybe she's going to get revenge on her brother Papa Midnight for killing her. Then we cut to John, and he is in a hotel room, and he's relaxing on the bed, and he's smiling as he looks up at the ceiling, and we get some narration of the exchange he just had with the concierge downstairs. So over this panel of him relaxing, we hear her voice say, And how will you be paying, Mr. Constantine? And John replies, Actually, love, I won't. But you'll just put that I have in your computer, what's it, eh? And bug us up some sarnies and a six-pack on room service while you're at it. And the woman replies, That'll do nicely, sir. Enjoy your stay. And as John thinks about this conversation, he chuckles to himself. And then we get some narration over him smiling on the bed saying, If only I'd stuck to using magic for stuff like that, instead of to screw me way around anything with a nice arse in the arcane underworld. If only bollocks. What's done is done, sunshine. Should have thought of that before you slipped Sharon Grant a length at the fifth form disco when she wanted to join your coven. Then John reaches over to his nightstand and he picks up his cigarette pack and he feels it's a little light and his narration continues. Christ. I'm halfway through me duty-free, and then it'll have to be the bloody luckies. Be getting lung cancer at this rate, you mark my words. So he stands up and pulls out a cigarette and lights it, and his narration continues. Through last year down the bog. Once Kit walked out, Jesus, what a useless bastard. Crawling around the streets and drinking horse piss. Wanker. Better get me arson gear then. Soon as this little rest breaks over, it's straight home and back in the saddle, because that frigger down in hell won't be wasting any time. Anyway, it's 4 o'clock. Time for a pint. So John grabs his coat, and he goes down to walk to the bar to meet Peter. And as we turn the page, we cut to John in the bar already with a pint, and he's talking to Peter behind the bar, and Peter's saying, "There's a place in Queens that does the best Guinness I ever tasted, but other than that, I wouldn't touch it. Doesn't travel. Ever tried the Jamaican stuff?" And as John takes a sip of his pint, he says, "Uh-uh." And then we cut to a panel of Peter still talking to him, but behind him, we see Papa Midnight standing behind Peter in his ceremonial garb, and I think he's just kind of astral projecting there. John doesn't see him, Peter doesn't notice him, and Papa Midnight says, "Oh yes, you have, Englishman. Just now in your beer, in fact. And you didn't even notice it go down, did you?" And as John finishes his drink, all of a sudden he gets kind of dizzy and he holds his head, and Papa Midnight continues, "You have fallen very, very far to be so malleable. You are going witch-walking, Constantine." And with that last line, Papa Midnight disappears, and it seems he's definitely cast some sort of spell on John, because John gets kind of dizzy and he leans back, and Pete asks, "You all right?" And John says, "Yeah, I just thought, sod it." So it seems maybe John did pick up on something, but I guess because he's so rusty and having been out of the game so long, and now he's kind of on vacation, so he's not expecting to be attacked. He just lights another cigarette and decides to ignore it. Then we cut to a little while later as John talks to another man at the bar, and he's saying, "To tell you the truth, mate, I doubt the bloody thing will make money." And the man says to John, "Hey, we'll at least clean up on the advertising." And John replies, "No one's gonna watch it. Look, Americans don't like football, soccer even, because there's not enough breaks and no chance of the odd maiming. And anyway, all the Irish reporters will get stopped at immigration, won't they?" And the man he's talking to begins to laugh very hard as John pretends to be an Irish football supporter trying to get through immigration in America. So he mocks, "Look, I'm an Irish football fan." And John pretends to be the immigration officer saying, "My ass, no green card. Shit, you mix will try anything." And as the man continues to laugh very hard at this impression, John gets another feeling that washes over him and it makes him close his eyes. And when he opens them next, he's staring at the wall behind the bar where all the bottles are. And then he focuses on one bottle. And inside that bottle, he sees the headless body of a white woman floating. And John doesn't take his eyes off the bottle as he says, "You see that?" Then he looks around suspiciously. And the man he was talking to has stopped laughing. And he's looking at John with concern and he says, "You okay?" And still looking at the man, John begins to bring his pint up to his mouth and he says, I think I'm... But he stops as he looks down at his pint glass and the hand that he's holding the glass with is a skeleton's hand. So he freaks out and screams, and then all of a sudden, the skeleton hand breaks apart and the glass falls down to the bar. Then we cut to a panel of the bartender Pete and the man John was talking to, looking very confused at John as he stares at his actual fleshy hand. So it seems John is having some kind of visions, and Pete is asking him, "John? John, what's the matter with you?" But John is still having his visions, even though they don't see it, and the man next to him says, "Uh-oh. Hey, I found a corpse in the alley this morning. I took a bite." And as John looks at the man say this, he sees the man has little jagged metal pieces for teeth. So John freaks out, and he stands up and begins to walk out, and Peter calls after him, but John doesn't notice, and then as John is about to walk out, there's a cat that's standing in between him and the door, and it begins to hiss at him. And Peter says to the cat, "Blarney, let him be!" But what John sees is Blarney the cat's face begin to melt off, so all you can see is his skeleton, and then there's a bunch of blood puddled underneath the cat. And then John takes off, and he runs out of the bar, which is in the back of this restaurant, I guess, because as he passes the front, we see there's like a little display where there's usually like cakes and pies and stuff on your way out, but instead of that, there's a bunch of fetuses hanging from umbilical cords just floating in this case. And as John runs out the door, Pete says to the man John was talking to, "What in God's name is wrong with him?" And the man says, "Hey, I didn't say anything." So then John takes off running down the street, and he's running so fast that he falls. And when he hits the ground, the street and city disappear, and he's in a void of black. And when he looks up, he sees what looks to be someone sitting behind a desk. And we can't see the man's face because it's covered in shadow, but we do see it is a bald white man, and he asks, "What are you doing on the friggin' floor, asshole? Come on, move it! You're next!" And John stands up, and he replies, Who are you? And the man says, Don't waste my time. Come on. And as John walks a little closer, he says, but where is this? And the man says angrily, you're some kind of friggin' retard. You're on Ellis Island, you prick. And then he picks up some papers and he starts to organize them on his desk. And then he picks up a pen like he's about to fill them out. And he says, okay, let me see. What is your name? And then John is looking kind of scared at this man. And his narration says, don't tell him. Screw him. Where the frig am I? And what the hell's going on? But John doesn't say that. He just looks at the man scared and says, John Constantine. And as the man fills out the paperwork, he says, I-N-E. What is your nationality? And then John kind of looks like he's gritting his teeth, like he's trying to fight whatever's going on here. And his narration says, what are you doing, you arsehole? Don't tell him. Don't tell him. But John tells him, British. And the man continues his questioning. And have you ever been in prison? And John, still struggling in his mind, says, oh God, oh Christ, oh freaking Jesus. What is this? Where are the bloody words coming from? Why can't I shut up? But he says to the man, yes. And the man says, surprise, surprise. And then continues his questions, saying, what is your destination in my country? And I guess because John is here on vacation, there is no destination, so he doesn't answer. And the bald man smiles and says, guess you'll find out soon enough, huh? Well, Mr. Constantine, welcome to the United States of America. And we're left with a full splash page of John not standing in the middle of a black room, but that man disappeared, and now he's standing amongst a bunch of very tall buildings that look like they're made of stone or concrete. And the perspective makes it look like they're like arching over John, like they're about to smother him. And John is looking around kind of scared, but there's only gray mist at the bottom of these buildings, so there's nothing else to see. So it seems Papa Midnight has put John in some sort of illusion, or possibly just John is having a vision of some dark version of New York. But we'll have to see for sure in the next issue. So if you guys have any comments, questions, or suggestions, you can email me at planes, trains, and comic books, all one word, at gmail.com. And we will see you on the next one.